Well, good morning. It's good to see you all this morning. We're entering a brand new section in the book of Jeremiah, and this is one of my favorite parts of the book, so I'm looking forward to it. If you didn't get a handout, raise your hand. We want to make sure everybody got one this morning. If you didn't get one, some of you have a green one. Yeah, that was also a prayer bulletin from Wednesday, so we got to work on that. But some of you don't. Most of you have a white one. We're going to be in Jeremiah chapter 30 this morning. Jeremiah chapter 30, this middle section of the book is interestingly placed, I will say. Rather than the book finishing at the end with his positive message, he kind of couches it in the middle, which is where we are. Jeremiah was called in chapter 1 to give a message to the people of Judah, a message that part of it would be good and part of it would be unpleasant. He says, preach, and you will have to tear down, to pull up, to destroy, but also to build and to plant. And through his message, sometimes he's looked at some people and says, well, if you're living right, then your life will be built and planted. And if you're not, then it will be torn down and pulled up. And so he goes back and forth. But this middle section of the book, Jeremiah 30 through 33, is his build and plant section. Long time at the very beginning of the book, he laid out the indictment of the people, the spiritual adultery they were living in, the breaking of the covenant that they had, the empty rituals that they had. And then he goes on and talks about the results in their life. They would experience loss and war and captivity. And the people reject the message because they don't like it. All the people reject the message. Priests reject it, prophets, kings, the regular people. Everybody didn't want to hear it because it wasn't very pleasant. But even in the end of this last section we've been studying, he does provide a glimmer of hope. This captivity that they will be going into to Babylon does have an end to it. They would go, and that would happen, but they would also return. However, in Jeremiah 30 through 33, that is the main purpose of this section. It's a message of hope. All of these chapters, now it's not a very, very long section, and it's split up into three major discourses. He has a sermon in chapters 30 through 31 where he preaches. We're only going to get half of it today. Then he gives an illustration where he does a lot of these illustrations, like not having a wife and kids, and he shows that, or wearing the yoke around his neck. Here he does one by buying a field in chapter 32. We're going to get to that in a couple weeks. And then there's one more sermon where God promises them peace in chapter 33. It's also in these next couple chapters that Jeremiah has the broadest view that he will have in the entire book. Jeremiah, unlike a lot of the prophets, tends to focus most of his book on the immediate circumstances. Have you noticed that? This is what's going on. This is what's going to happen in the next couple years. This is how it's going to take place. This is what you've been doing. Rarely does he broaden out and talk about God's grand plan. He does, but not as often as, say, Isaiah would or Ezekiel does. However, in these few chapters, he does that a little bit more, because what Israel's going through must be seen through the lens of what God intends to do through the course of history. And so he gives us that view. Israel is a huge part of this story. And there is also an end to the story. And the end is a good end, even though sometimes the path is difficult. And so we're going to walk through the very beginning of this book as we, before we get into the first point. The first point's kind of about what we're about to read, but I want us to look at it first. So let's everybody look down to verse number 1, and we're going to read down to the beginning of verse 11 as we walk through. I give you other passages as well in your notes, and so I'll let you glance at them as I mention them. So verse number 1 of chapter 30 says this: "The word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, Thus speaketh the Lord God of Israel, saying, Write thee all the words that I have spoken unto thee in a book." So now we have the book of Jeremiah. He puts them all together. "Lo, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will bring again the captivity of my people, Israel and Judah, saith the Lord. I will cause them to return to the land that I gave to their fathers to possess it. Now, Jeremiah explicitly is told, take all these things, write it in a book. And now, verse 4, these are the words that the Lord spake concerning Israel and concerning Judah. So he just begins to mention that, yes, they will go into captivity to Babylon. That will happen. And they will return. But what's interesting is he seeds in these couple of verses something that he's about to talk about. Because Jeremiah isn't preaching to Israel. He's preaching to Judah. Israel's gone. They've been gone. They've been gone for over 100 years. They were taken captive by Assyria a long time ago. There is no northern tribes of Israel right now. There's just Judah. And yet, in these last couple verses we read, verse 3 and 4, he says he's going to speak concerning Israel and Judah. Why? Because he's about to give a prophecy not just about the next 70 years, but about the rest of history with these people. Because God doesn't work his plan day by day. We live through his plan day by day. God's doing something much bigger than us. The Bible has prophesied long before that he would bring all of his people back to the land. It talks about that in Jeremiah chapter 16. I gave you the verse, you can look it up later. But it also talks about that all the way in the book of Romans. Romans chapter 11 says, all Israel shall be saved from all of these difficulties. As is written, there shall come out of Zion the deliverer and shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob. He says, I still have a plan for all of my people, not just for some of them. The nation together. And just as in their immediate future, they would go into captivity by Babylon, and Babylon would conquer, and then they would return to the land. Just as that would happen 70 years from now, he's going to prophesy about long in the future. And when all the people return back to the land and he gives peace way in the future, that will also happen after a great conquering of Babylon. Look at verse number 4. These are the words the Lord spake concerning Israel and concerning Judah. Thus saith the Lord, we have heard a voice of trembling, of fear, and not of peace. Ask ye now and see whether a man doth travail with child. Wherefore do I see every man with his hands on his loins as a woman in travail, and all faces are turned into paleness. Alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble, and he shall be saved out of it. There's an interesting verse in the middle. He says, just as women experience great pain in childbirth, which is the process of bringing forth new life, he says, all the men and women will experience great pains as this new era of renewal, a new era of life is being brought forth. Here he prophesies about a time of tribulation, but he's talking about the tribulation. The time of Jacob's trouble. In that day, it will be a day unlike any day that has ever been, he says. And it will be a time of trouble for them. He says that day is a great day. Not great how we say it. That was a great day. It was a great, like a lot of things are going to happen. And here he points to the future. Just as you're having tribulation now, and I'll return you from the land. In the future, you will have even a greater tribulation. I gave you a couple verses. Zephaniah tells us about this great day. The great day of the Lord is near. It's near, it hasteth greatly. The voice of the day of the Lord, the mighty man shall cry there bitterly. Look at Joel chapter 2. The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and terrible day of the Lord come. But in both of these passages, he says that Israel has another end to this. They will go through it, but they will come out of it. Just like they would go through this captivity of Babylon and will come out the other side, in the future, God will give them a great time of tribulation, and they will come out the other side. I gave you Daniel chapter 12, where he prophesies about this same thing. At that time, Michael shall stand up, the great prince which standeth for the people, for the children, I'm sorry, of thy people. There shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. And at that time, thy people shall be delivered. What part of the people? Every one that shall be found written in the book. Jeremiah and Daniel write very, very close to each other. But Jeremiah goes on. He talks about this great time of tribulation and turns the conversation to the time of deliverance for his people. Look at verse number 8 of Jeremiah 30. It shall come to pass in that day, saith the Lord of hosts, that I will break his yoke from off his neck. That's when the yoke will be broken. Not in 2 years. He says that that time will come in the future. I will break his yoke from off thy neck. I will burst thy bonds. Strangers shall no more serve themselves of him. They won't use you as slaves. They shall serve the Lord their God and David their king, whom I will raise up unto them. Therefore fear thou not, O my servant Jacob, saith the Lord, neither be dismayed, O Israel. For lo, I will save thee from afar, and thy seed from the land of their captivity, and Jacob shall return, and shall be in rest, and be quiet, and none shall make him afraid. Look at verse 11. For I am with thee, saith the Lord, to save thee, though I will make a full end of all nations whither I have scattered thee, yet will I not make a full end of thee. I will turn other nations to their end, but you I will allow to continue. He says you will no longer be slaves. You will serve a king once again that is from the family of David, even though you're going to, in the future, watch Zedekiah march off and never return. One day there will be somebody from the line of David. He'll sit on the throne and you'll serve him. And you will have rest and you will be quiet. This is the prophecy. One day there will be a greater tribulation than they would ever experience before. They will be persecuted like they never have before, but they will not be forgotten. They will be returned to the land, and the king from the line of David will sit on the throne. And Jeremiah uses this immediate moment of the difficulty they're having on a small scale and the restoration they'll have on a small scale to remind him of the difficulty that this world will experience on a grand scale. And the restoration this world will experience on a grand scale. And what he shows us in this passage is that God can and he will turn tribulation into restoration. What he does in this first message in chapters 30 through 31 is he shows how God can take what we have and he can turn it upside down and make it something good. There's three parts to this message that we're going to look at. Today is he turns tribulation into restoration. Next week, he turns mourning into joy. And the week after that, he can take our old covenant and make a new one. And each one of these things, God is able to change the situation that we have. What's interesting with this chapter is that there really is a twofold fulfillment of it. There is the partial, immediate fulfillment. Right now, you are going to captivity in Babylon. You will be restored to this land 70 years from now. The Lord will be your king once again. You'll serve him. But he also is pointing to the future. We know that this isn't going to be fully fulfilled in the next 70 years because he says you will no longer be slaves. Well, they would serve other nations. They would serve Persia. They would serve Greece. They would serve Rome. When you open up your New Testament, Rome is living in their land and they're being occupied. All their yoke hasn't been broken because in the future, there is a future fulfillment. There is a great tribulation followed by a great restoration of all things. But the opposite is true. Just as Jeremiah is able to look at today and then look at the future, we should be able to look at the future, and that should inform us about how we can serve the Lord today. See, looking at prophecy goes both ways. We can see what God's doing today, and it reminds us about what he's going to do in his grand story. But the grand story of what God's trying to tell us to do, he's going to do also informs us of how I'm supposed to live today. And it goes both ways. God is the great restorer of broken things. And that's why Jeremiah puts that message here. They are looking around, and their world is broken. And he says, and one day the world's going to be brokener than it is now. But I will fix it even to a greater degree than I will fix you. I can restore broken things. So very quickly today, I'm going to give you five truths about God's great restoration. Number one, I'm not going to reread the passage because number one is from the last 11 verses. God is always working a much bigger plan than we are. And he wants you to know it. God is always working a much bigger plan than we are, and he wants you to know it. Because these people aren't thinking about eschatology, are they? Their family just got taken to captivity. Their neighbor's not there anymore. They're wondering what kind of world my kids are going to grow up in. That's what they're worried about. They're wondering about if whether or not I'm going to graduate from school. My teacher's gone. What's that going to do to my education? The husband is saying, where am I going to get that piece of furniture built? Because the guy that I scheduled to build it now is gone. How am I going to do that? That's what they're worried about. Their immediate response wasn't to think, I wonder what God's going to do for the rest of history. That's not how we think, is it? When our lives get turned upside down. And yet, that's how he responds to it. He responds to their immediate issues by reminding them that their immediate issue is part of a much bigger story. It's so, so easy for us to get sidetracked by today and tomorrow and to feel like the whole world is just today and tomorrow. These are all the immediate concerns of Israel, but it's important for them to recognize that they truly need to have a bigger picture and focus. And so Jeremiah reminds them about the end, the very end, like the end end. He tells them the end of the story, like the one that doesn't get fulfilled until the end of the book of Revelation part of the story. This chapter begins, by the way, though, with God commanding Jeremiah to write it down. Take all these words and put them in a book. Because it wasn't just for this people, it was also for us. Because it is also true for us that we are always part of a much bigger story than whatever we're facing today and tomorrow. And God's doing something much grander than we tend to notice. And prophecy is a really good way to help us get that focus in mind. I know a lot of people say that prophecy is like the most important thing, and that's all they focus on. And then other people say prophecy is not important. I have a hard time saying prophecy is not important because for not being very important, the Bible sure does spend an awful lot of time on it, doesn't it? There are some things that the Bible does not spend a lot of time on. Those are not important. But why does he spend so much time on it? Because it's going to be what it is, right? Whether we know it or not. I would say that there's a lot of questions that we have that are not important, because those are the questions he doesn't answer. But I do not agree that prophecy is not important because the Bible spends a lot of time on it because it's supposed to inform the way I see the world I live in. I gave you a passage I read a couple weeks ago in 2 Peter chapter 3. He does the same thing. He says, knowing what's going to happen down the road, knowing the bigger picture, that informs what I do today. Look at verse 11 of 2 Peter 3. Seeing then that all these things shall be dissolved, what manner of persons ought ye to be? In all holy conversation and godliness, looking for and hasting unto the coming of the day of God, wherein the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved, the elements shall melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and new earth, wherein dwelleth righteousness. Wherefore, beloved, seeing that ye look for such things, be diligent that ye may be found of him in peace, without spot and blameless. If my view of the grand story is right, then my decisions about today will be right. That's what 2 Peter tells us. And that's why Jeremiah 30 is here. I must continue to remind myself that God's working a much bigger plan than I am. And so when today looks off, I can trust that God has tomorrow under control. God's working a bigger plan than we are, and he wants you to know it. Number two, we're going to move on in the chapter. Ultimately, we deserve every problem we endure. In the middle of this passage there, he's going to say, you're going to go into captivity, but I'll return you to the land. You will go into great tribulation, the time of great trouble for Jacob that was never like it was ever before. And I'll save you out of it. The temptation is to look at those verses and just say, well, God's just doing something. It's okay, but it's not because we deserved it. But that's what he tells us the opposite about here. If you have your attendance slip, can you just drop that in the plate when it goes by? We'd appreciate that. Put your name on it just so we know who else here in Sunday school. So look at the end of verse 11. Well, let's just read verse 11 again. Verse 11, he says, I'm with thee, saith the Lord, to save thee. I will make a full end of all nations whither I've scattered thee, yet will I not make a full end of thee. So he says, I will save you, and those wicked nations, I will destroy them. But he continues, but I will correct thee in measure, and will not leave thee altogether unpunished. I mean, if we learned anything from the book of Jeremiah, we should have learned that they deserved what came to them. It was their fault. They broke the covenant. They agreed to the terms, and this is part of the terms. He says, so I'm not going to leave you altogether unpunished. Look at verse 12. Thus saith the Lord, thy bruise is incurable, thy wound is grievous. There is none to plead thy cause, that thou mayest be bound up. Thou hast no healing medicines. All thy lovers, the people they went to trust, like Assyria and Egypt, all thy lovers have forgotten thee. They seek thee not. I have wounded thee with the wound of an enemy, with the chastisement of a cruel one, for the multitude of thine iniquity, because thy sins were increased. Why criest thou for thine affliction? Thy sorrow is incurable for the multitude of thine iniquity, because thy sins were increased. I have done these things unto thee. Here, God openly admits to the fact that he is the author of their captivity. And he will be the author of the great tribulation. And he justifies it because it was their sin and their iniquity that brought them to that place. They multiplied their iniquity. In the grand plan that God has, we do like to find solace in the fact that God brings all things together for our good. But yet somehow we equate that with the idea that we didn't deserve it along the way. But the problem is we only deserve judgment. And the moment God does any good to us, he does so out of his mercy, which we don't deserve. The bad part of our story is all things that we deserve to bring upon ourselves. We don't deserve a good end. We don't deserve for God to have mercy on us. That's the definition of mercy. It's not deserved. That's the definition of grace. We get favor that we don't merit. And so he purposely reminds us in the middle of this passage that every bad thing they would endure would be something that they brought upon themselves. They deserved it to happen. We cannot go and cry to God and complain as if he owes us for our lives to be better than they are. Just because God has a good end in mind and a good future in mind, and he wants to do us good, and he wants to see us successful, and he wants to give us peace, and he wants to give us rest, just because he wants to do all of those things doesn't mean that every bad thing we endure is not something that we deserve. The wages of sin is death. And all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, which means everything short of death that we have is already mercy. And so we can appreciate God's mercy more when we recognize that we do not get to lay claim to it as if it's God's responsibility to overlook how we have broken the covenant, how we have disregarded him. So ultimately, we deserve every problem that we endure, and yet that makes number three all the sweeter. And he puts these together. God is the great restorer. He is the great restorer. He blatantly takes responsibility for all the judgment. I have done these things unto thee. I did them. He doesn't try to sweeten it and act like it was someone else's fault. He said, I allowed it. I did it. And yet, we have the whole next section we're about to read. As new parents, I'm learning to discipline my kid. It was crazy how one day I just noticed he knows what I'm saying. He can't speak words to me. He says lots of things. None of them are words, but he can't communicate back and forth to me, but he knows when I say no, and he knows when something's okay. He does. He has for months now. Like when he was 6 months old, he knew whether or not something was okay or not. And I don't know why I knew that he knew, but I just did. And he did too. Yesterday he was doing something. I didn't know what he was doing. And I said, Levi. And he jumped and he looked at me like he knows when I'm talking to him. And the thing is, as a good father, I should be the greatest source of correction in his life. I should be the greatest source of discipline. I hope that I am the greatest source of pain and loss in his life. I would not want it to come from anyone else. Because at the same time, as a good father, I ought to be the greatest source of renewal in his life, and encouragement, and love, and acceptance. And if I'm going to be the father that I need to be, I must be the greatest source of both of them. God is the one who did all those things to them, and yet God would also be the one who does all the good. He should be the one who corrects us, and he is also the one who gives us acceptance in spite of us. As a good father, that's what he does for us. So I'm going to very quickly look at all the things that he has here. By the way, here in these passages, chapters 30 through 33, he's already done it in the passage, but he's going to seed in how this new king will come that will be over them and will love them and will guide them. And Jeremiah continues to prophesy about Jesus without them knowing fully who Jesus would be. And that's why I'm allowed to frame these points this way. Letter A. When no one pleads our case, Jesus will. When no one pleads our case, Jesus will. Go all the way back to verse 13. There is none to plead thy cause. They had no good lawyer. Nobody could get them out of it. They were guilty. No one was going to stand up for them. They deserved it. God was the author of it. And yet, verse 16, look at this new section. Therefore, all they that devour thee shall be devoured. All thine adversaries, every one of them shall go into captivity. They that spoil thee shall be a spoil. All they that prey upon thee will I give for a prey. Two verses ago, he says, no one's there to stand up for you. And now he's saying, all those who are your enemies, I will take care of them. Those are right next to each other. God was the greatest source of correction, and he was also the greatest source of restoration. Out of his mercy, Jesus pleaded their case. The Bible says that that's true of our Jesus. 1 John chapter 2 says, my little children, these things write I unto you that you sin not. If any man sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. Hebrews 7 says, wherefore he's able to save them to the uttermost, them that come to God by him, seeing he ever liveth, to make intercession for them. He says to them, you don't have a good lawyer. No one's there to stand up for your case. And in the New Testament, this Jesus that he prophesies in Jeremiah, he says, I will be the lawyer who will stand up for your case. He was the greatest source of correction and the greatest source of restoration. It is our own sin that makes us at odds with Christ. We have no case and we have no argument, and yet it is also God who is our advocate and intercessor, standing on our side and working for our best. Letter B, when we are enslaved, Jesus gives freedom. When we are enslaved, Jesus gives freedom. Go back all the way to verse number 8 of Jeremiah 30. It shall come to pass in that day, saith the Lord of hosts, that I will break his yoke from off thy neck, and it will burst thy bonds. Strangers shall no more serve themselves of him. Go down to verse 16, where he says that he will, all those who have gone, taken them into captivity, they will go into captivity. All they that prey upon thee will I give for a prey. They were in captivity, but Jesus will give them life. It is our own sin that enslaves us. But it is Christ that gives us freedom. The Bible says all the way in Romans chapter 6, know ye not that to whom ye yield yourselves servants to obey, his servants you are to whom you obey, whether of sin unto death or of obedience unto righteousness. But God be thanked that ye were the servants of sin, but ye've obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine which was delivered you. Being then made free from sin, ye became servants of righteousness. 2 Corinthians 3 says, Now the Lord is that Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. We deserve the slavery we bring into our own life. Israel deserved the slavery they brought into their own life. And yet, though God is the one who did all those things to them, God was also the one who was going to give them freedom. We do not give ourselves freedom. God does. We do not give ourselves liberation from our flesh. The Spirit of the Lord gives us liberty. And though it is our own actions that give us the slavery we have in our life to sin and to the world, God is still willing to, though we deserve the slavery we have, He is still willing to give us freedom in our life. Now, letter C, when we are hurt, Jesus gives healing. When we are hurt, Jesus gives healing. Go back to verse 13. There is none to plead thy cause that thou mayest be bound up. Thou hast no healing medicine. You cannot heal yourselves. But go down to verse 17. Look at this. I will restore health unto thee, and I will heal thee of thy wounds, saith the Lord. They brought their own pain, and God gave them healing. Verses away from each other. You have no healing medicine in yourself. It reminded me all the way back in Jeremiah chapter 8, where Jeremiah says, is there no balm in Gilead? Gilead was an area on the other side of the Jordan. They were known for having some healing salves that they would use. And Jeremiah used this as a picture to say, can we not heal ourselves? Do we not have the capabilities within our own nation to remedy our hurt that we're bringing into our life? Is there no balm in Gilead? The answer to the question was no. They couldn't heal themselves. That whole section, he's like, well, couldn't we do this? Well, couldn't we do this? Well, couldn't we do this? No, you can't. They had sinned against God. They were bringing pain into their life, and they couldn't just undo it because they wanted to. And yet here in this section, verses away from saying you have no healing medicine, he says, but I will heal your wounds. We hurt ourselves, and yet in the midst of that, Jesus is willing to give healing. When Jesus came, he said that he was the fulfillment of a prophecy in Isaiah. And he says in Luke 4, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He hath sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives, to recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty them that are bruised. Jesus said, I came to do those things for people who have put themselves in the spot that they have. There's a reason why there is a song that says there is a balm in Gilead. How many of you know that song? It's funny because it's quoted from Jeremiah. Jeremiah says, is there a balm in Gilead? The answer to the question is no. So I always like, well, what's the song about? Well, the thing is, no, there is no healing medicine that we can have, and yet God can still provide us that healing medicine through him. That's why that song says, sometimes I feel discouraged and deep I feel the pain, but in prayer the Holy Spirit revives my soul again. The balm in Gilead is not one that we conjure up within ourselves, but is one that Jesus gives us out of his mercy. Letter D, when our lives are broken down, Jesus builds it up again. Look at verse 18. Thus saith the Lord, behold, I will bring again the captivity of Jacob's tents, meaning that they'll come back. He'll turn the captivity around. I'll bring again the captivity of Jacob's tents and will have mercy on his dwelling places. The city shall be builded upon her own heap. The palaces shall remain after the manner thereof, and out of them shall proceed thanksgiving, the voice of them that make merry. I will multiply them, and they shall not be few. I will also glorify them, and they shall not be small. Their children also shall be as aforetime, and their congregation shall be established before me, and I will punish all that oppress them. He says, your towns that were broken down, they'll be built up again. The palace that was torn down will be built on the same spot that it was before. The children that are not playing in the streets any longer, they will play in the streets again. He brings them to an expected end. He says that even though your whole place is torn down, I can make it whole and bring it back to where it was. They were the ones who caused the destruction in their own life. And God did all those things to them, and yet he was also the one to build up their city again. Letter E. When we are unwanted, Jesus makes a way to be our family. When we are unwanted, Jesus makes a way to be our family. Go back to verse 17. I didn't read the whole verse earlier. I was saving the second half for here. I'll restore health unto thee, and I'll heal thee of thy wounds, saith the Lord. Because they called thee an outcast, saying, this is Zion, whom no man seeketh after. Literally means this. I will heal your wounds, even though the rest of this world's going to say that you're an outcast and no one wants you. This is Zion, who's looking for them. That was what they're going to be known for. He says that you're unwanted by the rest of this world, but you're not unwanted by me. Go down to verse 21. He's talking about the nation being built up again, the buildings being built, the palace being put back on the heap, right? And now he's going to talk about their new king. Verse 21, their nobles shall be of themselves, like of the people. Their governor shall proceed from the midst of them. He'll be one of them. I will cause him to draw near. He shall approach, the governor, unto me, God. For who is this that engaged his heart to approach unto me, saith the Lord? And, verse 22, the result of that, ye shall be my people, and I will be your God. The rest of this world says to Zion, no one wants you. And here he says, but I do. This new king, this governor, he says, will be from the people. This new governor will draw near to God himself. And the result of this governor being near to God himself will result in the people having a renewed relationship with God. Our sins have separated us from God. But here he's prophesying about that future king. Jesus came down to this earth and became one of us. He would be of the people so that he could go to God again on our behalf and we could be his people once again. This is all veiled in language that they don't understand, but as Christians, we get to look back at this and know exactly what he's talking about. I read this a minute ago. I'm going to give it back to you again. Hebrews chapter 7. It says this, wherefore he is able also to save them, talking about Jesus, to the uttermost, that come unto God by him, seeing he ever liveth to make intercession for them. For such an high priest became us, who's holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners, and is made higher than the heavens. He says, so he became us and went to God to make intercession for us so that we can come to God by him. They don't know all that means, but what they do know is this, that I don't know how he's going to manage to make us God's people again, but he will. 2 Corinthians 5 says, he hath made him to be sin for us, who knew no sin, that we might be made the righteousness of God in him. We don't deserve to be wanted, but he still wants us anyway. That's why all the way back in Psalms, he says, when my father and mother forsake me, then the Lord will take me up. I'll give you number 4. That's who Jesus is to us. But you know, Jeremiah, those people, they didn't know all of that. I just read a lot of New Testament that we can copy and paste into Jeremiah 30 because we have it. They didn't have that. There's just a lot of veiled references about some future bad time that's really bad, and a lot of veiled references about a governor that'll be from us, and he will be like David who sits on the throne, and he will go to God and draw near to him, and then we'll be his people. They don't know what all this means. This is what he says at the end of the chapter. He summarizes in a nice, sweet little way. Verse 23. The whirlwind of the Lord goeth forth with fury, a continuing whirlwind. It shall fall with pain upon the head of the wicked. The fierce anger of the Lord shall not return until he have done it, and until he perform the intents of his heart. In the latter days ye shall consider it. So he wraps it up into a package and says, I'll judge wickedness. I will do everything that I intend to do. In the latter days ye shall consider that. What does that mean? When that time comes, then you'll understand. And that's a really... He could put that on the end of a lot of chapters in the Bible, couldn't he? In the latter days, you'll consider it. When the time comes, you'll understand. Because they did not, I guarantee you, understand. And we don't fully understand. That's why we spend so much time trying to fill in all the blanks, because we desperately want to understand. We won't understand everything, but when the time comes, we will. And that's a reminder for us for today. God is working a bigger plan than we are. And he might show us some things and might give us direction of how to live today, but that doesn't mean he guarantees us to know all of it. But he does say that when it comes, we will. That's why the song says, farther along, we'll know all about it. And he tells us we'll understand it better by and by. That's your blank, by the way. I don't think I gave it to you. Number four. We'll understand it better by and by. We'll understand it better by and by. We just need to take a day at a time. We'll take care of our obedience and conversation and lifestyle today and let God take care of tomorrow. I'll give you number five, just one short little point before we're done. In this whole chapter, there is one imperative. One. He gives them a lot of information. He tells them a lot of things. And he gives one command. And it's in verse 10. Therefore, we ought not to be afraid. In the middle of this whole passage, there is one command. Verse 10. Therefore, fear thou not, O servant Jacob, saith the Lord. Neither be dismayed, O Israel. I will save thee from afar, and thy seed from the land of their captivity. Jacob shall return, shall be in rest, shall be quiet, and none shall make him afraid. When we get overwhelmed by today, we have to recognize that God has today and tomorrow under control. So we don't just need to vacillate about it and ulcerate about what's going to take place. He said, don't be afraid. This is what's going to happen. You'll understand it when you get there, but take it a day at a time. And this is part of his message of hope. God has it under control. He's doing a lot of things that we don't fully understand, but he is doing them, regardless of whether or not we understand them. He is the great restorer. We'll leave it there. We'll pick up the same message in chapter 31 next week, and so we'll look forward to that.